Does the U.S. Constitution need an update? Some Ohio Republicans think so. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll hear what those state lawmakers want to change and why. We'll also talk about how Kroger is firing back at Albertsons, the latest with Cincinnati's snowplow plans, and the joy and heartbreak of opening day. Joining me now to kick off the news review, our Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter, Haley B. Miller. Welcome back, Haley.
Good to be here.
And Cleveland.com chief politics reporter, Jeremy Pelzer. Thanks for being here, Jeremy.
Hi, Lucy. Great to be here.
Haley, tell us about this push to hold a convention to amend the U.S. Constitution. Who's behind it?
Yeah, so this is two Republicans and the Ohio House, and it's kind of a wonky issue. So the Constitution allows states to apply for a convention of states. It's under Article 5, and two-thirds of states have to do this, if I remember right. So Ohio was just one piece of the puzzle, but these lawmakers introduced a resolution to push for this. They say that we need to go back to the drawing table and specifically look at term limits for federal lawmakers and ways to kind of rein in government spending and reduce the power of the federal government.
And you said it would take two-thirds of the states to actually make this convention happen?
Yeah, so you need 34 states to apply for one of these conventions over the same issue. And we've seen some other states pass resolutions or legislation on the term limits piece of this specifically, but we're nowhere near the 34 that we need to do this at this point. There's a much easier way, or at least a less difficult way, to change the Constitution, which is Congress passing an amendment, but that's only happened a couple dozen times in the history of the U.S. Constitution.
Sure. I mean, you know, we all know there have been new amendments to the Constitution, but have they all been by Congress? Have any of them ever been passed by a convention of states?
No, it's all been Congress. A convention of states has never happened. And a lot of people are, you know, worried about what it could look like if states were to be successful in accomplishing this pretty tall order to get this convention going. But it seems quite unlikely. And even the lawmakers in Ohio introducing this resolution acknowledge that.
Well, tell us more about what critics say. Why are people worried about what could happen if these lawmakers and all these, you know, other states actually pull this off? Why do they think this would be a risky thing to do?
Yeah, so there are a lot of holes in terms of oversight of what a convention of states looks like. Article 5 of the Constitution doesn't say how the process should play out, and it doesn't require states to limit proposed amendments to the sort of agreed upon topic. So people are worried that interest groups and Republicans in particular could use this to really rewrite the entire Constitution. I talked to Common Cause Ohio Executive Director Catherine Turser, who pointed out that one of the things Ohio lawmakers want to do is draft amendments that would, quote, limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government. And Turser said, well, the Constitution is basically all about the power of the federal government. So does that just mean that they can kind of take a crack at whatever they want?
Have Ohio lawmakers pushed for changes to the Constitution before?
Yeah, this specific plan was introduced in a prior session. And then there have been seven times since 1788 that Ohio has submitted an application for a convention of states. These articles dealt with a range of things. One was about being opposed to polygamy. One was dealing with the election of senators. Ohio submitted an application in 2013 that was in support of a balanced budget amendment, which is something that's been pretty popular among fiscal conservatives, but again, has gotten nowhere near the threshold for one of these conventions.
Well, Jeremy Haley says that Convention of the States is a long shot. Let's talk about another long shot. Intel is about to break the terms of a deal. It gave the company $600 million in state grants. Talk about how the company's falling short and what the state can do about it.
Yeah, so if you remember back in 2022, this was touted as the largest economic development project in Ohio history. Intel pledged to spend $20 billion, now $28 billion, to build a massive computer chip manufacturing complex outside of Columbus. And as part of getting Intel to go to Ohio, the state offered a whole package of incentives to come here to Intel. And among those was a $600 million onshoring grant that was paid to Intel in 2023. And as part of the grant agreement, Intel agreed by the end of 2028, they would hire at least 3,000 full-time jobs, have new 3,000 new full-time jobs, have a payroll of at least $405 million, and invest at least $20 billion in the project. Well, the problem is that Intel now says they will open the first of these manufacturing facilities, because there's more than one hub in this complex. The first will open in 2030 or 2031. And that's obviously after the 2028 deadline. And so then the question is, okay, well, now that Intel isn't holding up its stated written end of the deal, what happens? Does the state try to claw back the money? And Attorney General Dave Yost, who I should mention is running for governor on the Republican side, is now saying that the wording of that is so broad that it would be hard for the state to claw back the money. And what he points to in particular is something saying that market, quote unquote, market conditions can be a factor. Intel has had a pretty bumpy ride since that deal was signed, both in terms of their stock price fell significantly. Their CEO got replaced. The CHIPS Act, which was a federal legislation to that gave $1.5 billion towards this project. That is, President Trump has criticized that. So the future of that is now a little bit up in the air. So there's a lot going on. And Dave Yost is saying if it doesn't work out, then the state wouldn't be able to get it back. One more thing I should add is it's not even clear when this opens, if it does open in 2020 or 31. Whether Intel will even have its name on it, because Intel might be looking to spin off its computer chip manufacturing side off to a different company completely. So a lot of unknowns at this point.
Yeah. You mentioned this idea of clawback provisions, and I know there are plenty of economic development incentives that have those clawback provisions where companies have to give back some of the money they get if they don't hit their targets. But it sounds like Attorney General Yost is saying, hey, this kind of has that, but the way it's worded, we couldn't probably really make use of those.
Well, I should say, too, that both the State Department of Development and Jobs Ohio, which is the state's economic development nonprofit, when they do these deals and the companies fall short, they don't say, well, you know, it's a day after the deadline, give us our money back. They usually work with these companies to try to negotiate some sort of way for them to meet the commitments. So it's not, everyone wants these companies to succeed. And so it wouldn't be just a matter of the day after on, you know, January 1st, 2029, that the state will grab the $600 million back, even if it could.
Sure. It's not like a parking ticket or something. So how far off is Intel from these targets? Can you remind us of the specifics about all that?
Well, Intel initially said they were going to be finished with the first of these hubs in 2025 this year. And obviously that got pushed back and pushed back. And now they're at 2020 or 2031, I guess. We'll see. I mean, they've started construction. So there's been articles and the company has touted, and the Governor Mike DeWine has touted how they've spent $7 billion, either spent or money they've committed towards construction. They poured an awful lot of concrete out in New Albany near Columbus. And but they've hired, I think, about 160 or so workers full time, which is a far cry from the 3,000 they've pledged to have by the end of 3 years from now.
Sure. Are they saying they still will eventually get to 3,000, or are they saying even that full time employment number will shrink because construction jobs are great, but those are temporary. I mean, the construction's finished and those jobs move on. They don't stick around long term, but these permanent jobs are kind of the name of the game, right?
That's a good point. The agreement specifies 3,000 full-time jobs, not construction jobs, like full-time working at this Intel plant once it opens. They're not temporary construction jobs. And the governor and Intel have expressed confidence that eventually, given the amount of money that Intel has already put into this project, that if not Intel, then whoever they sell this to will be making computer chips in the short to medium term future. So they're expressing confidence that this will happen. It's just taking longer than expected. The company also points out that this is one of the factors here is market demand. So if there's suddenly a big upswing in the demand for computer chips, they could still accelerate construction and be done by 2028 and meet the initial goals laid out in this agreement. They're just delaying it because of economic problems that the company's having.
Was there federal money involved in this deal too? If so, where does that stand?
So again, the CHIPS Act gave $1.5 billion towards this Intel plant, specifically in Ohio. This was passed with the help of many Republican Ohio Congress and Democratic members of Congress from Ohio. And President Trump has criticized this. And I know a number of Republicans have said they wouldn't have done this way, that they would have preferred to see like tax credits and other things other than just giving the money, you know, a straight government grant to Intel. It remains to be seen whether Congress would try to actually repeal the money or claw it back in some way. There's just been, since Trump took out office, growing criticism of the CHIPS Act. So it's right now it's just sort of up in the air and an uncertainty what might happen.
You mentioned what Dave Yost has said about this. Have you heard from any of the other people who are running to become Ohio's next governor? Any other comments from them about what's happening with Intel?
So Vivek Ramaswamy, the 2024 presidential candidate, is the only major Republican running against Yost. He's actually the front runner right now in that race. And he's one of those people, Republicans who I mentioned before, who are saying, I wouldn't have done it this way. Now, he stopped short of saying, well, we need to claw this money back and pull out and, you know, we'll have nothing to do with you. You know, he, along with just about everyone else, wants to see this Intel project go forward. He's just said that he would have done it a different way. To be honest, the only Democrat who's entered the race so far, Dr. Amy Acton, I haven't heard from her or her campaign yet about what she would do about this situation.
Okay. Well, I do want to back up just a little bit because we got a comment from Nicholas, a listener. Nicholas says, he wrote in an email, we have a lot of issues in Ohio right now that need to be fixed. Roads, library funding, maybe our state lawmakers should start there. And he was referring to the discussion about a convention of states to amend the U.S. Constitution. So that's what Nicholas had to say about that. I want to talk next about someone we haven't heard from in a while, and that's former U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown. Haley, he announced the launch of a new institute. Tell us about that institute and whether this could kind of set him up for another run for office.
Yeah, so he announced the Dignity of Work Institute, which Dignity of Work has always been one of his favorite lines and kind of his philosophy for his time in Senate and in Congress. So this organization is a nonprofit. He says it's nonpartisan and it will conduct research about the concerns of American workers and kind of examine the policy solutions out there that would work, would not work, maybe that, you know, Congress should be considering and aren't. They put out a survey as part of this launch that said, you know, a lot of Americans are said that they are juggling multiple jobs, think the economy and the political system is broken. So I think we can expect a lot more research and polls along those lines. And he said that this organization has nothing to do with his potential political ambitions, but of course his name is out there as a possible candidate for governor or US Senate in 2026. He said he still hasn't really decided what he's going to do, but I think Democrats in Ohio especially are waiting to see what he does next, because that would certainly have big ramifications for other candidates and just the dynamics of these races as a whole.
Sure. When would he need to announce a run for governor or U.S. Senate? What kind of time frame are we looking at?
Practically speaking, I think a lot of these deadlines are either later this year or early next year, but as we know, campaigns stretch on probably far longer than they need to. Republicans in the governor's race are, of course, already at it, as is Amy Acton. On the Senate side, we still haven't seen a lot yet from Senator John Husted in terms of his campaign, but that will likely start up soon. So I would guess, I mean, just based on how these campaign cycles work, I would say announcing by summer would probably be the smart thing.
Jeremy, what are you hearing from political watchers in Columbus? Are a lot of people expecting Sherrod Brown to throw his hat in the ring for one of these races?
It kind of goes up and down, especially with Democrats. I think about a month ago, there was a rising expectation that Sherrod Brown would jump in, probably for governor. However, this was kind of more based on kind of people's hope and just their personal expectations than any inside information. There are signs that Sherrod Brown will not run for governor. For example, Amy Acton, who again is the only Democrat running for governor right now, her campaign consultant is Justin Baraski, who's a former Sherrod Brown campaign manager. Her top fundraiser was Sherrod Brown's fundraiser. And then, there's little inside indications like that that there was an expectation, right or not, that Sherrod Brown would not enter the race. And as Haley said, Sherrod Brown has the luxury, unlike any other Democrat, of taking his time to make a decision. If he gets in the Senate, which right now there's no Democrat who's launched for Senate in 2026, and in the governor's race, which has started unusually early, even by creeping longer continuous campaign standards in Ohio, he can wait till spring or early summer and either clear the field or reach some sort of arrangement to enter the race. And that's something that no other Democrat has. So he has time, but at the same time, he's got to start making a decision pretty soon, and at least behind the scenes, start trying to find ways to make sure that all those machinations behind the scenes are ready by the time he announces.
Sure, either of those races is going to mean a lot of fundraising, I'm sure.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Inquirer politics reporter Haley B. Miller and Cleveland.com chief politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Up next, the Kroger-Albertsons food fight intensifies. This is Cincinnati Edition. 2 years after Kroger and Albertsons announced plans to merge, the deal fell apart. Now the two grocers are fighting in court about who's to blame. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We continue our news review talking about that legal battle and get an update on the latest from Cincinnati City Hall. Joining me now are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter Steve Watkins. Welcome back, Steve.
Thanks, Lucy. Glad to be here.
And WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks for being here, Becca.
Happy to be here, Lucy.
We appreciate both of you being here. Steve, Kroger's failed merger with Albertsons is back in the news. Remind us when these merger talks started, how big a deal this was, and what this merger would have meant for Kroger.
Yeah, it's been quite a long saga. It started back in October of 2022. So now it's been almost 2.5 years ago. That's when Kroger and Albertsons agreed to a deal. It would have been the largest merger of U.S. supermarkets in history. Kroger had agreed to buy Albertsons for $24.6 billion. So a huge acquisition. They knew there were going to be issues with antitrust, and they had worked a lot over the years and even before that to try to make sure they were resolving any concerns from federal agencies that are charged with making sure these kind of deals aren't anti-competitive. So they reached the deal back in October 2022, did a lot of lobbying and things like that. Various lawsuits were filed back in February of 2024. The Federal Trade Commission sued Kroger in federal court, saying this deal is anti-competitive, it violates antitrust laws, and it shouldn't go forward. That case ended up being heard in Oregon back in September, and the judge ruled December 10th in favor of the FTC and basically against Kroger and Albertsons. There was another process they could have pursued after that, but they didn't. And that very same day, one of the state attorney general's lawsuits seeking also to halt the deal, a judge in Washington state ruled against it. So both these rulings came out the same day, probably not coincidentally. And the next day, Albertsons first said, we're calling off the deal and we're suing Kroger, blaming them for it not going through. And later that day, Kroger said, we're calling off the deal too. And here we are.
It's kind of like who broke up first, I guess, at this point.
It kind of is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So there were all these legal challenges. The deal gets derailed. Albertsons filed this lawsuit against Kroger in December. What was Albertsons arguing in that lawsuit? What do they say Kroger did to, you know, make things go wrong?
Ultimately, Albertsons primarily wanted back, or they wanted a payment from Kroger of $600 million. It's called a termination fee, and it's negotiated into a merger, typically. And the fee is meant to be paid because Albertsons spent 2 years, essentially, working with Kroger rather than trying to find somebody else to buy it. And so there's a lost opportunity there. There's a lot of costs involved, obviously, in trying to get this deal done. And so these termination fees are negotiated into the deal. Albertsons claimed that Kroger did not pursue all of its best efforts, as Albertsons said, to make the deal happen. They argue that partway through, Kroger could see the handwriting on the wall and really didn't pull out all the stops really to get the deal done. And Albertson said, we want our $600 million termination fee and other damages and costs associated with it. And Kroger filed earlier this week an answer in court saying, no, that's not right. We're not at fault here. In fact, you guys, Albertsons, are at fault. So they made counterclaims in the lawsuit while also saying, hey, we pursued this and you guys were the ones that pulled the plug first. Going back to your point, Lucy, who broke up first? And Kroger is kind of lobbing or firing, I should say, probably right back at Albertsons and saying, no, it's your fault that this didn't get done. And they want damages paid.
And as I understand it from your reporting, Kroger is saying Albertsons stood to gain from undermining Kroger's attempts to appease regulators. What is Kroger saying Albertsons would gain by that? Just being able to kind of set itself up for this termination fee?
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit of a confusing argument. Actually, there's two kind of key prongs to Kroger's argument in this countersuit. One is that they say Albertsons negotiated separately, and this gets even a little bit more confusing. There's a third company involved called CNS Wholesale Grocers. They agreed to buy hundreds of stores from Kroger as part of Kroger's effort to appease regulators and say, look, in some of these markets where there's only one Kroger store and one Albertsons store, and this merger will eliminate competition, we'll resolve that by selling some of these stores to an outside operator. That's CNS. So CNS ultimately agreed to buy 579 stores across much of the country that were in markets where there wasn't much other competition. Kroger claims that Albertsons was working directly with CNS kind of behind the scenes, and there was testimony in court that Albertsons, in fact, was doing this on private cell phones and things talking to CNS and essentially trying to work a deal to get CNS to buy even more stores. Albertsons, at least in Kroger's mind, Albertsons viewed this as a way to get regulators to say, yes, this is okay. And Albertsons essentially felt like Kroger wasn't doing enough to try to sell enough stores to get the regulators to give the okay.
A love triangle. That's what you're saying, Steve.
That is well put.
So
And one that didn't work out too, by the way.
right, exactly. That happens sometimes. So I know you have said it's pretty common for companies to go after each other in court when a merger deal like this goes south. What are you going to be watching for with Kroger? Are you expecting that all this could result in any big cost cutting or big local changes?
Locally, I don't know that it directly is going to involve much in the way of changes. I wouldn't expect that. What is likely to happen right now, I don't think there's even a court date set for this. And probably what's likely to happen in these kind of things is there would be some kind of settlement. I mean, there's a point where this deal is done. How much more money do you want to spend in court arguing this back and forth? And it's probably relatively likely there will be a settlement. As far one of the things that's interesting though is in Albertson's statement, kind of responding to Kroger's allegations earlier this week, the first sentence Albertson said is Kroger's weak claims are a deliberate tactic to distract from its own ongoing executive leadership issues, along with blatant and recurring failures to carry out its contractual obligations under the merger agreement and avoid paying the damages it owes to Albertsons. So they brought up the issue, the biggest issue that Kroger's dealing with right now, which is its CEO, Rodney McMullen, resigned after an investigation into personal conduct. That happened about a month ago, so well after the Albertsons deal fell through. But Kroger is still in the midst of trying to find out or find a permanent CEO. They have an interim in place, but Kroger is dealing with that too. And that is very likely their biggest concern in the boardroom at this point.
These breakups can get ugly. Well, let's turn to City Hall. A city council member raised concerns about the amount of time Cincinnati police spend to investigate interstate crashes. Becca, what did Councilmember Mark Jeffries find in that regard?
So, Councilmember Mark Jeffries had requested a report from the Cincinnati Police Department looking at how many things like how many citations have been issued over the last several years, breaking that down by police district and neighborhood, that kind of thing. But one of the other things he asked was how much time, in terms of like hours, investigatory hours, have Cincinnati police officers spent investigating crashes on the interstates? So, this is just looking at I-74, I-71, and I-75 within the city of Cincinnati, obviously not the whole stretch of those interstates. And with some caveats, what the police department reported is that officers last year in 2024 spent up to 1,500 hours investigating crashes. Now, there are a couple of outliers in there that kind of skew the numbers up a little bit. But the other caveat is that this doesn't include the kind of fatal crashes. So those are ones that take a lot more time to investigate. So it's a little bit of a fuzzy number, but more likely the number is higher than that. And this is kind of a minimum number. And that is quite a bit of time, for officers to spend on those crash investigations. And Mark Jeffrey's point is, if someone else was doing those crash investigations, then our local officers would have a lot more time to do their general patrol or do more traffic enforcement, which is something that some neighborhoods are asking for.
Yeah, so he's saying, hey, should Ohio State Patrol be doing that instead?
Yeah, absolutely. And his point is, according to him, State Highway Patrol is already doing that in other parts of the state. Now, of course, State Highway Patrol, it's in the name. They are patrolling the highways. But in some cases, it's not just in the sort of outside of the cities. And according to Councilmember Jeffries, they are also doing these crash investigations in some municipalities, like in Mason is his example. Now, my other caveat, there's always caveats in journalism, I guess. But my other caveat to that is we did reach out to the State Highway Patrol to confirm that and, get some comment from them on how common it is for them to be doing this kind of work in other municipalities. We did not hear back, so haven't had a chance to get their perspective on this.
Well, what did Cincinnati police say about this idea?
Yeah, so this came up in a city council meeting in which some CPD officials were presenting on the information, the report that Councilmember Jeffries had requested. So we got to hear from a couple of CPD officers, including the traffic commander, and that's Lieutenant Robert Van Horn. He says that the department has a very positive working relationship with the State Highway Patrol right now. And he seemed hesitant to kind of do anything that would damage that positive relationship. So there is some collaboration that happens already, for example, during big events like opening day is a good example. Other times that there are, you know, maybe a lot of things going on downtown, the State Highway Patrol will send officers to help out with crowd control and things like that. They've also partnered with the State Highway Patrol on traffic blitzes. So that's something that's been done as recently as last year. And it, like I said, Lieutenant Robert Van Horn, the traffic commander, seemed a little hesitant to kind of ask them to take on any more in case that might damage that relationship. There are also some concerns about there's sort of two things at play here. One is, could State Highway Patrol do actual traffic enforcement on the highways in the city? That would mean like pulling people over for speeding or reckless driving or having a taillight out, that kind of thing. There seems to be some agreement between city council and the Cincinnati police that that's maybe not the best idea. One of those reasons is the city has a collaborative agreement that is followed, you know, in which they commit to certain things like keeping track of racial disparities in traffic stops and, you know, being aware and cautious of avoiding, you know, racial disparities, also in how they interact with folks. And anecdotally as well, the Cincinnati police officers say, like, you're more likely to get a ticket from a State Highway Patrol than you are from a Cincinnati police officer. So some potential concerns about how they interact with the public, and it's just a different mindset in terms of community policing versus, you know, what the State Highway Patrol does. But then this other piece of investigating crashes, this seemed to be more like what Councilmember Jeffries is focused on. And the concern there is, you know, does State Highway Patrol have the capacity to take that on? They don't have a post in Hamilton County like they do in some other local counties. But, you know, even separate from that, it seems likely that or it seems apparent that the State Highway Patrol has some of the same recruiting difficulties that Cincinnati Police does and that most law enforcement agencies across the country are having right now. It's difficult to find people who are interested in becoming a law enforcement officer. And so do they even have the capacity to do that? Those are questions that are not answered and that Cincinnati police officials are maybe a little bit more cautious about.
Okay. Well, I know you will keep on top of that. I also want to ask you about snow plows. The weather's so nice now.
Oh,
but
it's gorgeous.
Yes. We talked earlier this week on the program about the big winter storm, the city's response to it. What's the latest with snowplow purchases, and what will that mean for the other stuff the city needs, like fire trucks, ambulances, all that?
Yeah, so this was a little bit of an interesting conversation here. So normally these kinds of purchases are made during the city's biennial budget. We are coming up on budget season. We're actually kind of already started budget season for the next city budget. But this discussion happened outside of that. Basically, there's some money left over from the last fiscal year. It's called the carryover budget. It happens every year. City Council had sort of set this aside and to decide what to do with earlier this year. So they had decided, City Council decided, we're going to spend about, it's not quite $1 million, about $994 million.
$1,000.
Thank
yes.
you. So not quite $1 million. Like, we want this to go to city fleet because the fleet of vehicles at the city, there's all kinds of things that are outdated, difficult to repair and get parts, old vehicles. It needs a lot of attention. But then there was a lot of confusion about what they were going to buy with that money. The answer came out this week that council had left it up to city administration, and the city manager announced this week that they are going to use that money to purchase 3 single axle snow trucks. So these are, I think, dump trucks, basically, with the snow plow on front. And that means that they're not using that money to buy a new fire truck, which is something that the fire department was specifically requesting for this money. But a fire truck would cost a little over $1 million, and there wasn't quite that much available in this particular pot of funding. Ambulances was another option. That was something the city administration had said, this is something else that we definitely really need. And those are just examples from a couple of departments. You know, fleet really does need attention from all across the board in departments. But as I said, this is something that usually happens during the regular budget. So it's certainly not the end of the discussion. There will be other opportunities for departments to request vehicles. And the police and fire department have already done that and asked for a little attention in the budget for that. But that's where things stand right now.
And I know you'll be following that budget all those discussions very, very closely, which we appreciate. I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter Steve Watkins and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll get the skinny on opening day and what's ahead for the Reds this season. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. There were lots of things to love about the Reds' opening day yesterday. The final score of the baseball game was not one of them. Joining me now to talk about what happened and what to expect in the season ahead is Local 12 digital sports reporter and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Welcome back, Richard.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Thanks for being here. I know some Reds fans are probably still hurting from yesterday's opening day loss. The Reds were leading for most of that game. What happened?
Well, they're down a closer. Alexis Diaz, who has been the closer the last two seasons, was put on the IL to start the season. I don't know how hurt he is. They're trying to work through some mechanical issues that really have cropped up for him, but technically he's on the IL. So they weren't really sure. I don't think Terry Francona was totally sure who he was going to have close. And he turned to Ian Jabeau, who only pitched two games last year, had a forearm issue, did pitch great in spring, but doesn't have a lot of experience as a closer, only has four career saves. He had some other options in the bullpen that have experience closing. Scott Barlow, who threw a scoreless inning, is one of those guys. Taylor Rogers, who they got in a trade with the Giants, is another. He's got a couple of 30 save seasons under his belt. So certainly there's a lot of second guessing that can go on of, you know, why you turned to Ian Jabeau in that spot. And I think he's going to probably spend the first couple of weeks of the season trying to figure out who is going to close. And unfortunately, you may have another growing pain or two along those lines moving forward. I know they like Ian Jabeau's stuff, but just closing games is a different animal. It's a different mindset. There's a lot of guys that can pitch in the sixth, seventh, and eighth inning. There's not a lot of guys that can pitch effectively in the ninth inning, and certainly Ian Jabeau did not pitch effectively yesterday.
So is this Ian Jabeau's fault, or is this the decision to put Ian Jabeau in the game that's at fault?
Yeah, no, I mean, he admitted he didn't execute his pitches, you know, left the ball out over the plate that he wishes he had back that was belted for a three-run home run. So some of it on him. And like I said, some of it, again, it's always easy to second guess. And I'll give Terry Francona credit. He says, I make a decision. I don't go back on my decision. I try to learn from whatever that decision was, and maybe he will. You know, Scott Barlow did pitch yesterday. He was the first of the relievers. Actually, Emilio Pagan's also got experience as a closer. Maybe he just loved Ian Jabeau's stuff. Like I mentioned, he pitched really well in spring. Maybe he thought it was his time to become a closer. Sometimes you don't know who can close games until you try him in that role. Yeah. And maybe he felt like I got myself to a spot where I've got a guy with great stuff coming off a great spring to close this game out. And it just didn't happen. And sometimes that's just the game.
Yeah. So what did that tell you about where the team has weaknesses?
Well, there's no doubt that I don't think that's going to be a total weakness, but until you find out who can do it, or until Alexis Diaz can come back and he can do it, you just don't know. The other thing is probably outfield offense. That was a big point of concern, I think, for fans going into the offseason. How can you help yourself and add to the outfield offense? They thought they did it when they got Austin Hayes, and unfortunately he started the year on the IL. He's not going to be on it for very long. He's got a minor calf issue, but late in spring when they were kind of putting out their opening day lineup, for lack of a better term, he was hitting cleanup. Well, he's not in the lineup yesterday. And so Gavin Lux ended up having to bat cleanup. And, you know, he's probably going to be using in a major utility role this year, but I don't think he's probably a middle of the order guy. So I would still say outfield offense until it says otherwise. You know, TJ Friedl did have a couple hits yesterday, but Jake Fraley, who started in right field, didn't have any. Gavin Lux, who started in left field, had one. But that was, I think, a major concern for everybody, is where is the outfield offense going to come from? And then at catcher, I mean, Tyler Stevenson is probably a number six or seven hitter in this lineup when he's healthy, but he starts the year on the IL. And Jose Trevino, who's a really good defensive catcher, is now the starting catcher, and he bats ninth and went 0 for 2 yesterday. So there's a little bit of a hole offensively there. So we'll see if some of the other guys can pick up the slack. Matt McClain came back, you know, after not playing last year, went 0 for 5. I think he's still a little rusty. He was okay in the spring. I think he had a 630 OPS. It wasn't anything off the charts. But, you know, I think for that guy, as the season rolls along, he's going to produce, but it may take some time. The one thing you hope is what all these little holes are, that they don't dig this team into a hole too deep into this season.
There you go. What about some of the stars? What did you think of how Hunter Green performed? Ellie De La Cruz, what did you think of them?
Yeah, I thought Hunter Green was off the charts great. He made one bad pitch, gave up a two-run homer, but struck out eight. I mean, he looked absolutely dominant at times, only walked one, gave up three hits. Again, one of those, though, unfortunately, was a two-run homer. But I thought he looked great. I think he's going to have a great season. His last seven starts last year, he was just off the charts. He had the last four starts of spring were really good to great, so I think he'll pick up where he left off. He finished eighth in the Cy Young voting last year. I think he's got a legit chance to maybe be in the conversation for a Cy Young award this season. And then, of course, Ellie De La Cruz, who I think the big thing for him is, can he cut down on his strikeouts? He did strike out once yesterday, but he looked really good at the plate. He went 1-for-3, scored a couple of runs. I think he's going to have a huge season as well. I wouldn't be shocked to see him finish in the top five, top three in MVP voting. Probably nobody's going to win the MVP as long as Shohei Ohtani's healthy and upright. He's going to win it because not only can he hit, but he's going to be back to pitching this year too. But you get Ellie in that conversation, you know, top three or so in MVP voting. That means he's going to have a great year and really help this team.
Hmm. This is just one game, of course, but does it tell you anything about what we can expect from the Reds this season?
No, and I think we always do this, and I'm not pointing the finger at you. We all do this. If they had won that game, it would have been, oh, my gosh, they were terrible in one-run games last year. Now they've turned that around, and they win 3-2. Okay, new manager. What a great job he did to manage the end of that ball game. He got them the win, and now it's, I were questioning his usage in the bullpen, right? Where we're looking around going, yeah, they outfield offense was a problem. Is it going to be a problem again? I think there's always an overreaction to that. And unfortunately, in Cincinnati, you know, we have opening day, and then it's always a day off afterwards, and then it's kids' opening day on that Saturday. So that gives us a full day to digest all of this. And again, like I said, overreact either good or bad to the end result.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears and talk about basketball for a few minutes. Xavier was the only local team to make the men's NCAA tournament, won its first game, and lost its coach to the school it beat. How unusual is that?
Very. That was odd. I mean, you know, this had been talked about for a while. I did a radio show down at the Holy Grail at the Banks last Thursday on a station on the AM side down the dial. And it was a college basketball show, and one of the other guys who did it was on before me is my podcast partner, Rick Broering, who covers Xavier for 24/7 sports. And so I got done with my segment. It was about 11:30. We were going to hang around, watch those early games on Thursday. And his phone starts blowing up about Sean Miller to Texas. And about four or five phone calls into it, he came back and looked at me. He goes, I think this is a done deal. I said, well, it can't be a done deal, obviously, until Xavier's out of the tournament. Xavier still had beaten, to your point, had beaten Texas the night before on that Wednesday night. They still had a game with Illinois on Friday. He said, I'm just telling you, it'll be a done deal as soon as Xavier's out of the tournament. And obviously, it, you know, came about very quickly. Texas fired their coach officially on Sunday morning. And by Sunday late afternoon, early evening, Sean Miller was heading to Texas as its coach. And so it was a strange timing, I guess, for lack of a better term. But, I mean, college basketball is in a strange timing element. The transfer portal opened on Monday. I'll use Kentucky as an example. Kentucky plays tonight, and as a grad, I'm looking forward to that game. But Kentucky just got a commitment transfer today from a kid from Tulane named Cam Williams. They're already getting guys out of the portal, which you're allowed to do. The portal opened on Monday. But there are some guys playing in this tournament that are probably going to, as soon as their team is out, hop into the portal. And so it's just a weird time, the transfer portal to open up while this is going on. I know, you know, most teams are already out of the tournament. It's only, you know, the teams in the tournament's affecting to some degree, but like I said, Kentucky just got a guy, and Xavier's basically lost its whole roster to the transfer portal.
Well, and then it seems like everybody thought Xavier would bring back Chris Mack to be the new coach. Surprise, the university hired Richard Pitino. What did you think of that decision?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, again, as I mentioned, Rick Broering, who covers Xavier, we talked about this on the podcast the other day, and you know, we both were told that Chris was probably going to be the guy, and I think donors wanted Chris to be the guy, but I think the athletic director Greg Christopher, who came in when Chris was the coach, you know, he then, after Chris left for Louisville, hired Travis Steele, who was an assistant, and that was kind of the path Xavier always went. They did they went from within, and it was a great formula for them. Travis, though, it didn't work out so much. So then we're on to, Sean Miller's available. Let's bring him back to the fold. I think donors really wanted that. And I think Greg Christopher said, okay, yeah, this is bring him back. I think this time around, Rick made a really good point of that Greg Christopher probably wanted to break ties with that and say, you know, I want my own guy. I'm going to just make a clean break from what we've been doing. And I think it was a surprise to everybody that Chris was not the coach. And so he went out and hired Richard Pitino. Now, Richard was looking to get out of New Mexico. He had been rumored with the Villanova job as well. In this coaching carousel, he was probably going to land somewhere, and he winds up landing at Xavier.
He's the son of Rick Pitino, of course. What kind of team do you think he's inheriting? How strong is the roster?
It's not, and he's got his work cut out for him. So as I mentioned, as of today now, everybody who logged a varsity minute for Xavier last year is either out of eligibility or in the transfer portal. They've got Dalen Swain, who was a starter last year, Ryan Conwell, who was their second leading scorer last year, and then John Hughley, a backup center, Cameron Fletcher, who didn't play a ton, and Trey Green, who didn't play at all and was always going in the portal. They have two guys on the roster left that redshirted this past year. One is Roddy Anderson, who transferred from Boise State, and the other is Lasina Traore, who got hurt before last year started, would have been the starting center. That's it. Everybody else on the roster, I mean, they didn't log varsity minutes. They have no varsity minutes. They do have two incoming freshmen, a guard, Nick Lewis, and another guard, Jaden Forsyth, 2 4-stars. They signed letters of intent, so you hope that they are coming, but that's 4 guys. Last I know, you at least have to have 5 to play the game. So there's a lot of work. But, you know, listen, he's not alone. Mark Pope at Kentucky, when he took over for John Calipari, he literally had to build his roster from scratch. And he's obviously done a good enough job of it to get him to the Sweet 16. So you can do that. It just takes a lot of work. And that's probably what Richard Pitino, they've not even held an introductory press conference for him yet. My guess is he's working hard getting guys in the portal.
Too busy. Well, and we only have a few seconds left, but he could face off against his dad, right, in the Big East? That's something.
Oh, he will. Yeah, they play round robin, so he'll get a chance to face him twice. That'll be quite interesting, father-son in the same conference.
Yeah. Well, I've been talking with Local 12 digital sports reporter and host of the Skinny Podcast, Richard Skinner. Thanks so much for your time today, Richard.
Anytime, Lucy. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.